Okay, everyone, are we ready to roll?
Yep.
We are.
Keith, Camilla, Alex is with us as well. This is another episode of Good Charity, Bad Charity. We're here to take on today quite a substantial charity. We're talking about Age UK. Lots of issues to discuss, including a substantial call on their services during lockdown, a loss of income as a result of charity shops having to be closed during lockdown. So a charity coping with its own specific list of challenges. Camilla.
And on the wave of the whole issue which has been exercising people for at least the last 20 or 30 years, which is we are all getting older. We are all going to need some sort of care. We would all like that care to be bespoke. As Paul Street said, we'd like the Savile Row care, not the Primark. That's going to be a major issue, not just for Age UK, but for all of us.
Keith?
Yeah, what have they gone through? The merger that has obviously spun off in a variety of different ways for them. And when we look back about what we're trying to do here on our podcast, there must be a lot of leadership challenges that they've had to address to be somewhere near sustainable to go forward for the future.
Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness is with us as well. Alex, I guess you'd be interested as well in the federal nature of Age UK as it is now.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to explore as a federated charity with around 140 autonomous, what are termed brand partners, so the Age UK that you see on your local high street, and just really to see how that model has worked through such a period of crisis and uncertainty.
And probably a heightened awareness as a result of COVID, the very pointed effect that that's had in care homes, the number of deaths which have occurred amongst that older percentile of individuals, which is really quite shocking. Bigger issues about how we see the care of our older generation.
Just adding to that really, David, and I know from experience around here in Wales, that the local age support charities here have had to fundamentally change how they deliver their services. They've had to spend more time out of the offices. They're not dealing now in groups. It's more individual. So I just wonder how they've also got involved with all that.
What's really interesting when we start talking about age is if you talk about teenagers, there's a defined period. If you talk about young adults or children, there's a defined period. Elderly, it's over 60. Mm. So Age UK is providing a service to anybody from the age of 60 to 100. That's a 40-year period. You could have two lots of children in that time. Who is going to be
Steady
doing
on.
That caring?
Don't tell Keith that, for goodness sake.
Who is going to be volunteering?
So let's just do the reveal. Our guest is Steph Harland, who is the CEO of Age UK. Lots of questions, which hopefully we've all prepped for. Steph Harland has been the CEO of Age UK since January 2018, having joined one of its predecessor organisations, Age Concern England, in 2002. Before that, Steph worked in the voluntary sector locally, nationally and internationally, mainly on issues to do with older people and adults with care needs. Steph was closely involved in the creation of Age UK, as we now know it, in 2009, and since then has had a number of different roles within the organisation, focusing on its international work, its strategy and its governance. So, Steph, welcome to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We're delighted to have you here. Just give us a snapshot of how it's been for you over the last 12 months.
Busy, challenging. Our shops have been often closed, but also sometimes open and operating under new social distancing rules. And we have managed to shift our very important telephone services, where we're answering the phone to older people 365 days a year. We managed to shift out of our call centres into home-based working, which was a real feat on the part of the staff who achieved that.
Yeah.
The other thing that's phenomenally important in Age UK is that we really have a huge number of users of our website already, and we knew that people would be coming to the website and looking for really timely information, and we've seen huge traffic to our coronavirus pages throughout the year. And it was really obvious from the word go that our organisations were among those that people would turn to with new problems and new dilemmas and the kinds of challenges that were suddenly facing people. So we needed to be really on the front foot supporting them across the country.
None of us can have missed the news reports on the impact that coronavirus has had on older people, not just people in care homes, but in general in the population. Alongside the work that you've been doing, there must be a lot of tragedy and heartache that people have had to cope with.
We would always be very mindful that the pandemic has had really difficult implications for lots of different groups in society, but the vast majority of people who have actually died are people from older age groups.
Yeah.
We think that there will be quite a long tail of physical, psychological and mental health problems that will be with people for some time to come. We know that quite a lot of people's physical fitness has deteriorated quite a lot. We also should be careful not to stereotype older people. And we know that older people, for example, have, of course, lived long lives, have had a lot of experience. There is some evidence suggesting that older age groups may have coped better than much younger people in some ways. And the same thing is true in the pandemic as was true anyway. We have a society in which inequalities between older people are growing. And I have at this point, of course, to mention the really detrimental impact on the health of older people from BAME communities of the virus, because we know it hasn't affected all older people equally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously we've seen images of people trying to communicate with their loved ones through windows. And, you know, it's brought it home to people. Do you think there might well be an impact beyond the coronavirus period when we see actually, you know, we have to re-examine how we are treating the older generation?
We really hope so. And it's really important that we don't all forget quite quickly. There has been an increasing gap in the funding available to support social care and to an extent the healthcare of older people over the last couple of decades. So it is in some ways a really big moment for organisations that are concerned for older people and for other people who have other care needs, that the public has seen and engaged with and thought about the lives of people who are often not very much considered. But we have just seen the budget come and go without action on the funding of social care. Mm-hmm. My colleagues are, of course, and other organisations are hot on the case. But it is really important that as a country that we really do think about how it is possible for everybody to plan and save for their later life.
Yeah. Keith?
Yes, we can hope that that's the case. You're a federation with lots of associate groups. In proportion to how many older people you support to those, is there a major difference? Are you duplicating in some ways or is it a clear divide?
No, I think our services are very complementary. We've evolved together over 80 years and we have a whole raft of ways in which we support the local organisations around the country with the different kinds of services and activities that they're doing locally. As a national charity, we don't deliver face-to-face, but that's because we have local partners who do that.
Yeah.
Steph, as I understand it, you are an umbrella. You have individual organisations and they themselves are charities. They themselves raise money. They themselves put their accounts into the Charities Commission and all of that. And when you look at those, there is quite a range of income. And I guess one of the things I'd be concerned about is that, you know, if Lincolnshire has 2 million a year and Barrow-in-Furness only has 200,000, whatever it is, do you see yourself as having any kind of equalization facility? I hate the word levelling up, so I'm not going to use it.
We actually did a bit of an experiment during the last year. We did an emergency appeal to raise money for the services of the national and the local charities. And we had a lot of debate with our local partners about how some of that money should be divided up, whether it needed to be targeted on those areas which needed it most.
That's what I was wondering.
And we really put on the table some of the facts and figures for different regions about the size of population, about the levels of deprivation. That's an easier and more straightforward discussion when you've got a pot of money that is national in scope.
Yep.
It becomes more difficult, and local trustees have actually said this to me, if you're a trustee of a local charity, perhaps in quite a wealthy area of the country, can you be justified in some kind of element of pooling and supporting others? There is already a kind of redistributive element towards the funding that we make available to our local partners, but whether we should be going further and whether in these constrained circumstances we should be increasing our focus on those areas where it's least likely that the local AGK can survive and that there will be other organisations locally working with older people that can pick up the slack.
How closely do you work with local authorities then, who in the main, with their social services, are also trying to pick up with some of the support?
Responsibilities for social services, as you say, rest with local government. So one of the things that's really strong about the federated model that I love and I will champion is that if you're constituted the way we are, then a local AGK can really get to know the local authority, the local health service, with other voluntary and community sector organisations. And if you were talking to our local AGKs, they would say, and they often do, that their relationships with other people with whom they're acting together locally are just as important as their relationships with us in the national charity or their peers across the country.
Yeah.
If I can take us back to the beginning of lockdown, one of the very noticeable observations early on, I think it was actually Esther Ranson who pointed it out, that charity shops and charity giving was going to be affected because shops would have to close because volunteers were largely from an older age group. They were all shielding. And I think you've already said, is it a third of the Age UK charity shops will probably not reopen? Tell us about how that's going to change the organisation in terms of the revenue and where you're looking for alternative revenue, in a sense.
We have lost a phenomenal amount of money through the closure of our shops, about £30 million in income.
Right.
Really?
Pretty much £900,000 a week in cash from week one of the financial year. And in fact, it started before that. So we knew we had to act. And one of the things we did is we took a really hard look at the retail estate. And we decided that what we needed to do was close about a third of the shops that we had at the time of the pandemic. So last April, we had about 400 shops. Now we have just under 260. We had a number of shops that weren't very profitable, perhaps. And we thought that the challenges that they would be under when we were able to open would make it very, very hard for them to be in profit at all. So we did some really phenomenal work on that and got some great outside help as well as our team internally to really help us crunch the numbers and work that one out. What we'd hope in terms of our finances, and we've got some really good indications that this is going to work, is that in keeping the more profitable shops, when we get back to full trading, we are hoping that the profit that they will be able to generate will pretty much equal what we were making before. And if anything, we've been wanting to work in a way to make our shops a bit more profitable.
You've also shifted the trading online.
We've had phenomenal amounts of donations, as everybody said that everyone spent lockdown clearing out their cupboards. And gosh, when we opened the shops, it turned out it was true. And one of the things we've actually been able to use some of the premises that we're not reopening for is to store some of this extraordinary amount of stuff that people kind of rushed in through the door and started hurling at us as soon as they could. But we've also been doing a lot more on eBay. And I think sort of selling online has got to be one of the kind of crucial developments for the future.
I'm interested in the role of the charity shops in terms of enhancing AGE's visibility in the local community and what steps you've had to consider in terms of the closure of 130 shops. How can you get that communication? How can you maintain that visibility and maintain the relationships that perhaps that physical asset had with individuals, but that will no longer be there?
Well, we're able to communicate with a lot of people who donate regularly to our shops and customers who come in, not least because they have given us permission to do that when they become a gift aid donor. So we've done some quite nice communications while the shops have been closed with some of the people who regularly donate to us, reminding them of our basic telephone numbers and telling them that we're really, really keen to see them again and we're looking forward to seeing them again.
You talk about trying to maintain the revenue in the face of the difficulties that we've had. And Age UK also runs Age Co, which is a business in itself, which sells, endorses products aimed at older people, travel insurance, profits from which all go to the charity. Previously, I know there was some criticism for promoting expensive energy packages, which presumably you've acted on. But presumably, you've got to be careful, you know, it doesn't sort of damage your reputation in some way.
Yes, I think what's really important to us, and it's very clearly understood between both the charity and the trading company, AgeCo, is that we stick to the trading principles that we've set out. And they're quite simple. They're three Ps. First of all, the products have to be genuinely right for the audience and for the customers. We have to have a price that is fair and right. And we do think that neither the customers nor we ourselves consider that the profit we make should be excessive.
One of the things that has been talked about recently in the context generally of income is there may be a rise in legacy income. Now, how do you approach that sensitively? And I'd be really interested to know, when you have legacies, who gives a legacy?
The people who are most likely to leave us a legacy are people who've had a connection with us, but that connection is most likely to be through giving to us. So there's a thought sometimes in our sector in particular that the people who give you legacies might be people who've used your services. The sort of detailed evidence doesn't bear that out. In fact, if anything, we can see in some of the stories of people who've given us money that they've been giving us money for a long time, and sometimes they have used some of our services towards the end of our lives, but their relationship to us and maybe making their will has predated that. What I think is really, really important for all charities now is to recognise that to leave us part of your estate, to leave us money, is an extraordinary trust that you're placing in us. And I think people are less and less willing to just sort of take it on trust from charities. They need to know that you do feel accountable to them and that you are going to be worthy of their trust. We can't take people for granted.
The question that I really want to focus on now, really, the population is ageing and the statistics show by 2050 that one in four is going to be considered old, whatever old means. That's a scary figure.
Steph has just opened her mouth in astonishment at what you've just said, Keith.
Yeah, I know, but we're here for a conversation. You know,
we are.
What you were saying is government haven't recognised some of the funding. Have we not got almost like a pandemic coming on later on in our lives?
First of all, one of the things that I always want to say is that human ageing, demographic change, is one of the most profound changes that our world has ever known. It's as profound as climate change, in my view. But unlike climate change, it's a good thing. Everyone here has the opportunity to live much longer, of accessing the kinds of healthcare that in my lifetime was unthinkable. In the 60s, when my grandfather had angina and he had a big heart attack, they told him to go home and sit very still. Today, surgery, you'd have a balloon put in somewhere and you'd be home and they'd be telling you to go out and start training for the marathon. I mean, the vast majority of the people you're talking about, that quarter of the population, will be thriving, active citizens till much, much later in their lives. They will be packing out stadiums and with their aging rock bands that, you know, won't give the youngsters a look in. They will be volunteering. They'll be looking after grandchildren. They will be continuing to be the largest care workforce in the level of unpaid care they give to other older people, because that's who's doing the unpaid caring. A much, much smaller number of people will face really difficult problems. Where we have a massive problem as a society is that the gap in the amount of funding that's available to pay for social care and potentially the healthcare that people need is growing ever bigger. One of the reasons why, in principle, as a society, we ought to be able to solve that problem is that really it's about how we can all plan and save for our later life. There's lots of great research which show that many people are ready to make some form of contribution. So we need something that allows everyone in the population the ability to plan for their later life. Because if someone in their 20s asked you today how they should prepare for the possibility that they might need care at the end of their life, and it is only a possibility, it's not really possible to tell them what they should do. We can't assure them today that the tax and national insurance they pay will suffice, because it won't. Yep. The Prime Minister made a very clear personal commitment to fix social care when elected, and we in Age UK and a lot of other people intend to hold him to account for that.
Oh, I was just wondering if government's actually listening, Steph, because it's all very well to put all these things down and you have in a parliamentary brief about what your aspirations are. Presumably, you would like money to go to the sector. You would like a designated person in government that you're talking to. Are you getting any of that?
One of the most perplexing questions for somebody like me who's spent a lot of my life thinking about these issues off and on is that the availability or otherwise, the costs or otherwise of social care is something that touches so many of us personally. We've experienced of it in our own families, with our parents, our grandparents, our spouses, our sisters, our brothers, but it hasn't as yet risen to being such a high priority to voters that government and opposition cannot afford to ignore it.
Yeah.
One thing I would say is that I don't think it's going to take one person in government. For this to really change, you need sponsorship from the Prime Minister of the day, and we need the Treasury to really be willing to look at this again. And I wish they would listen to this podcast.
And it's a recurring theme, isn't it, that we've heard time and time again in terms of this constant struggle to try and get the ears of those who are really holding the decision-making rule and also the checkbook.
And this is a really, really huge decision involving billions over decades. So it really needs support from the very centre.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our guest today is Steph Harland, the CEO of Age UK. Keith.
You quoted two things, I think, early in the conversation. Was about you've now almost closed your call centre, okay, and people are working from home. And the potential economic and environmental, I think, savings from using Zoom in other ways rather than driving around the country on trains or cars. Do you agree now that you're going to continue with those, or do you see yourself going back to everybody in the room?
When we did a big survey of our staff last summer, almost nobody wanted to go back to exactly the way it was before.
Right.
But equally, it was only a minority of people who said, I want to stay at home all of the time forever. We're just going out to ask our staff again what they think now. And I have a pretty strong feeling, and I think everybody who's lived through the last few months can relate to this, I have a pretty strong feeling that our staff may feel a bit different now than they did in August. Indeed. It's been a long, hard winter. But I still think that we will not be going back to exactly the way it was before.
Just sort of finally, how are you looking after yourself in all of this?
This is like a therapy session, Steph, in case you haven't.
Absolutely.
This is where Camilla becomes your therapist in chief.
I'm not sure that I personally have been as good at that as I have told my staff that they need to be. In fact, you probably shouldn't put this bit in the podcast.
That's guaranteed to keep it in.
What I can.
Yes, quite.
Doing things like going to Alex's CAS CC Chief Executive's breakfast, which is a therapy session sometimes, as well as a very good discussion. We've also been supporting each other to do things like step away from the screen, go outside, have a cup of tea, see the sunshine. So I think we've put a lot of stress in the organisation on really encouraging our staff to have those good habits of self-care. And I think I'm better at preaching than practicing sometimes.
Alex.
I was going to ask about leadership learnings. You know, so many people who listen to the podcast are leaders, whether it's the micro charity around a kitchen table or equivalent, right the way through to the larger national ones like yourself. But really, you know, any nugget to share? I mean, we've touched on the well-being, obviously the team play and the collegiality. Perhaps a third learning about leading through a period of such crisis?
It's been really necessary to keep on adapting what you're doing to what's happening right now. So there've been a lot of different phases in the last year, absolute crisis management mode in sort of April, through other periods where your eyes are right down on what matters in the next 24 hours or the next week, through to other periods where you've got the chance to look a bit further ahead. And I think success is probably, and I don't wish to claim that I've always achieved this at all, but I think that it's about those quite rapid gear changes and how far out you need to be looking today. Is this the moment to look ahead to the next 3, 4, 5 years? And then do I need to switch back to next week?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask one final question, which is, taking you back to October 2019, Age UK took over the activities of Silver Line, Dame Esther Ranson's great baby that she developed over a number of years. She confessed on our podcast to having founder syndrome, finding that a very difficult time in handing over the reins. How was it for you?
It was a wonderful experience. I mean, one of the things that's magical about Silver Line, and one of the reasons why it was such a compelling story from the beginning, is that Esther has been honest in sharing what it was that she had experienced herself directly, and we're talking about bereavement and the loss of her husband, that really inspired her to create Silver Line. And the other thing is, when a long time ago, not with Silver Line, I had a little look round at all the sort of literature and articles about founder syndrome, and it's nearly always bad. So I said to myself, and Esther and I have had this conversation, I'm sure this can be done well. And it's not easy for somebody to let go of this child into which they've placed deeply personal emotion, commitment, thought, hours of time. But I'm really interested to see how we can do it well.
There we go. Thank you for your honesty, your frankness, and sharing with us. It's been great. Steph Harland, CEO of Age UK. Thank you very much. Incredibly frank observations there from Steph. And if you were making a movie of her experience during lockdown, there would be a very dramatic scene when she sees £900,000 a week disappearing from her bank account. But she does seem to have kind of survived it.
Yeah. And she's got to think now, what do I do about that? One of the things we've never talked about on the podcast is legacy income, which is a huge percentage of many large charities' income. And I think that generally charities are predicting their legacy income may go up. But then you have to handle that incredibly sensitively. And what I really liked from what Steph said, it is all about building relationships.
Yeah.
So first build the relationship, then maybe you have a regular donor, then the regular donor leaves you something in their will.
I think, I've been critical about the number of adverts that keep coming out on daytime television. But I have to say, the one that was the most moving for me was, I think it was the cancer one, where two people were sat there with the lawyer saying, I'm reading the will, and you will receive X as a family, and Peter is a beneficiary of it because he now has cancer treatment once a week. And that was quite a powerful way of the charity actually saying, we can help lots of people through your will.
It'd be interesting to see almost how messaging changes a little bit, won't it, as a result of us having the sort of visceral images of older people during this lockdown period, struggling in care homes, et cetera, it will be interesting to see what the impact on giving is going to be.
Absolutely. And we're having that conversation at the moment because my wife's mother has fallen, broken her shoulder, 89, in hospital, needs care. Yep. What the heck's going to happen?
Where's she going to go?
She doesn't want to go into a care home. Thinking about it at the last minute is really challenging. And I think it's a wake-up call for us to say, maybe we should put in our wills, information to the kids to say, this is what, we need. And maybe that'll help in the future. And that'll help that consequences that we were talking about of having a much older percentage of people in the country by 2030.
70 is the new 60 and 60 is the new 50, I'm guessing, as well.
Yeah. Well, I love the way that Steph celebrated that increase by 2050. One in four of us is going to be over 65, I think was the statistic. And she obviously felt, as many of us do, that that's something to be celebrated. And there's so many amazing role models out there. And then the roles often that we can play during those decades in terms of supporting organisations and building that relationship that might ultimately lead to donating a sum of money to them when you do get to that far end of those three or four decades.
Yeah, and I love it, but I still believe there are consequences that financially the country isn't ready for yet.
She's carrying that message on a big placard to government, isn't she? I mean, that positioning statement she gave presumably the position statement she's put into her government.
And that was the point I was picking up on, because she is talking to government. And with that passion she had about it, I'm hoping that she will succeed where I think a lot of other people may fail.
Yeah. As a result of that conversation with Steph, I've now discovered the Age UK eBay page. I've already bought stuff. So, Alex, I've got you an Easter-themed floral headdress. That set me back £6.50.
Thanks, David.
Keith, I've got you a dinky toy model of a Mark I Corvette Destroyer in its original packaging for 20
really?
Quid. And Camilla, you'll love this. I've got you a pair of satin cheetah print pyjamas for a fiver.
Ba-bum.
I hope you got something for yourself, David.
I want to make sure that whatever it is you get for me, I can take to the Antiques Roadshow.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. Find more episodes on goodcharitybadcharity.com or find us on Twitter on @GCBCPodcast. Many thanks to Dan Hardoon of Whittledown Productions, to the Centre for Charity Effectiveness and the City Bridge Trust. Till the next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.